Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the conviction today of former Liberian President Charles Taylor on charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Amira Woods, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus, who is originally from Liberia, joins us to discuss how this mass murderer, who was sprung from a US prison by the CIA, only to end up as a protege of Gaddafi's running a murderous guns for diamond racket, was able to delay justice for so long. Then, as the president barnstorms across the country talking to students about how the Republican Ryan budget wants to double interest rates on student loans, we will speak with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, where he has an exclusive article, Washington Post, Kaplan, and other for-profit colleges joined ALEC. We'll discuss the burgeoning taxpayer-funded for-profit college racket that recruits aspiring minorities and vets into penury with lifelong student loan debts, worthless diplomas, and no job prospects, all on your dime. Then finally, we'll speak with Steve Scroven, the organizer of a political comedy event for Public Citizen. He made An Unreasonable Man, the documentary on the life of the founder of Public Citizen, Ralph Nader, and we will discuss how comedians today provide better news coverage than network TV anchors. KPFK is a media sponsor of this year's political comedy show, Stand Up for Main Street, hosted by Steve Scroven at the Writers Guild Theatre this Sunday, April the 29th at 6:30 p.m. And joining us now is Amira Woods, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's an expert on U.S. foreign policy with a special emphasis on Africa and the developing world. She was program manager for the Committee on Development Policy and Practice at Interaction, serving as its principal staff contact for advocacy at the United Nations, the International Financial Institutions, USAID, and Treasury. Previous to that, she served as a program officer of Oxfam America's Africa Program. A native Liberia, Amira serves on the board of directors of Global Justice and Financial Policy Forum and is the chair of the board of Africa Action and serves on the advisory committee of the Zimbabwe Alliance as well as the Humanity United Trust Africa Liberia Program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amira Woods.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And I guess in the case of Charles Taylor here before the International Criminal Court, it's a case of not so much justice denied, but certainly justice delayed, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Justice delayed, but not denied. It has taken quite some time, but the people of Sierra Leone, the day before their Independence Day, actually, are celebrating because justice has been served. I think the Charles Taylor verdict shows that no one, even a sitting head of state, is above the law.
Well, you mentioned in a piece that you wrote that he's the first head of state. Well, there's a lot of firsts. He's the first head of state to escape from a U.S. medium security prison, the first head of state to publicly refuse to sign an imbalanced rubber concession agreement with Firestone Tire and Rubber, and he's the first sitting head of state to be brought on charges for international crimes against humanity, and now, of course, the first head of state since World War II to have been convicted of war crimes by an international criminal court. Let's deal with the escape from a prison in Boston. Can you sketch that first out for us?
Well, that's the irony here. You know, Charles Taylor was the finance minister of a previous government in Liberia, escaped allegedly with about 900,000 U.S. in cash to the United States, and was detained in a medium security prison in Massachusetts, allegedly to be extradited back to Liberia. But somehow, it's quite clear, Charles Taylor on the stand under oath in The Hague testified that with support of the U.S. CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, that he was able to, quote-unquote, escape that medium security prison in Massachusetts and make his way out of the U.S. onto a plane and into Africa. So it's a sordid story that implicates many, including the U.S., but I think it's also important to underscore that implicated in this quagmire really is also Muammar Gaddafi, the former ruler dictator of Libya, because Charles Taylor, after he left that prison in the United States, somehow ended up in Libya to be armed and trained, along with Fode Sanko from Sierra Leone, essentially trained and financed by Libya, went off to West Africa, where they unleashed a reign of terror that killed 250,000 Liberians and 50,000 Sierra Leoneans. So it's a a long and complex web of atrocities that finally today has been brought to justice.
Well, it's a bit odd, isn't it? Again, I'm speaking with Amira Woods, who is originally from Liberia. She's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. It's odd that the CIA would spring Taylor from a jail here in the United States, and that he would then end up working for being an asset of Gaddafi's. You know, and Gaddafi, the reason he was funding Taylor was to beat out Liberia's U.S.-backed dictator Samuel Doe.
Well, that's why I think it's important to recognize that geopolitical, proxies can play dangerous diplomatic dances, right? So you had a very clear indictment and a guilty charge of Taylor, both working towards peace and involving himself in peace negotiations in Sierra Leone, while aiding and abetting the very forces that were undermining peace and orchestrating the repression in Sierra Leone. You also had some duplicitous roles being played. The United States was backing then-dictator in Liberia, Samuel Doe, and he was seen as a friend of the United States, had come to the White House under Ronald Reagan, welcomed in the White House with much fanfare, and was actually supported through military hardware and training by the United States, while at the same time, Charles Taylor was also allowed to, again, by the CIA and others, according to all these reports now and now testimony of Taylor in this trial, the CIA also aided and abetted Taylor. And I think it is that role of these geopolitical actors that is sometimes running amok in crises in Africa and other places around the world.
So, Amira Woods, specifically the charges of the 11 charges today, it wasn't convicted on all of them. They range from murder, rape, sexual violence, the recruitment and use of child soldiers, etc. The bottom line is that he, Taylor, is accused of running a Guns for Diamonds scheme with Diamond Rich, Sierra Leone next door. And he was also, of course, as you mentioned earlier, Gaddafi's proxy. And he met with the head of the IUF, Sanko, where they were both backed by Gaddafi. And, of course, some of this came to light earlier with the gift of Taylor's giving a blood diamond to the supermodel Naomi Campbell. But what went on, what the RUF did in Sierra Leone, along with killing, what was the figure you had, 250,000 died in Liberia because of Taylor's activity. How many died in Sierra Leone?
50,000.
But so what was prevalent there was this amputation. You know, a way to terrorize and recruit child soldiers was they used amputation.
Well, I think there was unspeakable violence, right? So you had women being targeted for sexual rape and sexual violence, also the use of women as sex slaves and cooks and what have you. You also had the targeting of civilians who would not go along with the rebel forces. Were brutalized, and including this massive use of essentially hacking off the limbs of those who refused to join the forces. So civilian targets, I think, were most brutally treated in this war. And I think the verdict of Taylor was that while he did not command and control the forces on the Sierra Leonean side of the border directly, that he did aid and abet. He provided the weapons, the ammunition, the financial backing to ensure that those unspeakable acts continued to unimpeded in many respects in Sierra Leone, and that the flow of diamonds out is very sort of high-quality, high-grade supply of diamonds would continue to flow into his coffers on the Liberia side of the border as well. So this flow, this illicit trade of arms for diamonds, I think, is also a key element of this indictment and why he was actually found guilty.
Again, I'm speaking with Amira Woods, who's originally from Liberia. She's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. And curiously enough, his, Taylor's wife, is in the Liberian Parliament. I read something about her recently calling for the execution of homosexuals, something extraordinary like that. There was never any, I mean, he was media savvy. He came across as a sort of cultured, had a kind of sort of British accent, you know. How did this guy get away with it? I mean, there are two questions, really. How did he get away with it for so long? And secondly, was he just an unbelievable sociopath? I mean, what motive, what possible, you know, how could a human being be that depraved?
Well, I think choices are made by people who want power and want to control and access resources. And those choices can be made by someone like Charles Taylor, a very educated, person with economics training, a former finance minister. Those atrocities can also be carried forward by people in wealthy countries, including the United States and the UK and many other places. So I think what we have now is an international community that has put forward standards, new standards, for the 21st century, recognizing that we need new mechanisms of accountability and really creating, 10 years ago now, this International Criminal Court. I think our challenge is to make sure that the rules of the road apply to all and not only bring forward indictments and charges on people in the African on the African continent, but that to make sure that all of the international community, all who violate human rights, international law, international humanitarian law, human dignity, are held accountable, whether they come from the United States, the UK, or China, or Russia, or anywhere else on this planet.
Well, you mentioned, we talked earlier about how Taylor, as a head of state, publicly refused to sign an imbalanced rubber concession agreement with Firestone Tire and Rubber. Interestingly enough, the country, of course, Liberia, was founded by freed American slaves, and one of the main American pioneers, if you will, of Liberia was Marcus Garvey, who created a shipping line and got people to sign up and emigrate to Liberia, and he bought enormous amounts of land in Liberia. And then, of course, the Americans were always looking for a way to break the British and French rubber trust, and then they discovered that you could actually grow rubber in Liberia. So Firestone Tire and Rubber used a J. Edgar Hoover to bring charges against Marcus Garvey for alleged Ponzi scheme, and therefore have the whole plan of Garvey's collapse, and then Firestone Tire and Rubber ended up with all this land on which they grew rubber.
Well, clearly Firestone has a sordid history in Liberia. Liberia remains the largest rubber operations in the world. And Firestone started in 1926 and has built their profits on the backs of farmers who were dispossessed of their lands. For Firestone to have that million acres on which they planted rubber, people were thrown off the land. What many called the first in what has been a long history of land grabs in Liberia and other African countries, began then with Firestone and its efforts to control the rubber market. But I think, what's worse is that you have had continuing till now, the 21st century, the use of child labor on those plantations. They're still called plantations because actually they are built on a system designed in the antebellum South, where the Liberians are primarily the laborers living in dilapidated housing, some of which was built back in 1926, and even the ones that were more recently built still have no indoor plumbing, no indoor lighting or electricity. Essentially taking the models that were constructed in 1926 and having two rooms instead of one, but very little other changes. So rendering the workers invisible.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Amira Woods.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Amira Woods, who co-directs the Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's a native of Liberia and serves on the board of directors of Global Justice and the Financial Policy Forum, and is chair of the board of Africa Action, and serves on the advisory committee of the Zimbabwe Alliance, as well as the Humanity United Trust Africa Liberia Project. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about student loans with the president barnstorming around the country. Killed the Tsar and its ministers, Anastasia screamed in vain. I rode a tank, held a generous rank, when the blitzkrieg raged and the bodies sank. Pleased to meet you, hope you guess my name. Oh yeah. Can't afford anything anymore. Trying to get myself a university degree, but I'm just getting poor. It's about 6 months ago I had money in the bank. If the dollar were a drop of gasoline, I'd be running on an empty tank. I can't afford these happy times. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He has a new article at republicreport.org. It's an exclusive. Washington Post's Kaplan and other for-profit colleges joined ALEC, the controversial special interest lobby. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thank you, Ian. The show's almost over by the time you read all my resume.
Well, I'm actually impressed. I had no idea that you had a background in national security, which is pretty much my beat for this radio show. But we're talking about for-profit colleges because they are so egregious and such an example of what is wrong with Washington. It's a bipartisan scandal, the idea that federal tax dollars are being siphoned, sent to these people who hold up a shingle, get these poor kids, a lot of them are vets coming in on the GI Bill, gave them a worthless education, get them saddled with debts for life, and all on the public dime. And of course, they spend an awful lot of the public dime promoting themselves. All of our listeners have surely seen advertisements on television for all of these new for-profit colleges that keep popping up. Well, talk about run out of time. You better stop me, David, and start speaking.
Well, I mean, I agree with everything you said. I mean, I would say there are some good programs in the for-profit college sector. There are bad programs in the nonprofit and public sectors, but a lot of the problems are with the for-profits, tend to have the highest prices, or some of the highest prices, the lowest graduation rates, the highest dropout rates, and lots of deceptive recruiting. Senator Kay Hagan from North Carolina just had a piece in the paper today where she talks about how veterans are, you know, people sneak on campus, sneak on military bases, not supposed to be there, and recruit people, injured, wounded veterans who don't even know what they've been hit with. And they're suddenly signed up for classes because the sales pitch was so smooth or so manipulative. And then they get into programs that they can't afford to be in that don't do them any good. They end up with lots of debt. And some of these students, even if they do complete the course, it turns out that it doesn't actually train them for the job they thought they were promised it would train them for. Or it does train them for it, but the price was so high that they get the job that they dreamed of, and they still can't pay back their loans because the job, in fact, is not a high-paying job in the restaurant industry or something else, but the tuition was as if they'd gone to USC.
Well, of course, the president's been barnstorming around the country, and it was yesterday in Iowa speaking to college students about this, not so much the student for-profit college racket, but the idea that the Republicans are going to double student loans starting in July, which it looks as if they're going to back away from that, right? I think Boehner recognized the political damage there if he followed the Ryan proposal. What do you expect to happen tomorrow in the House? And next week in the Senate, they're going to take it up.
I don't know. I mean, the problem is, I mean, everyone seemed to suddenly agree that doubling the interest rate from 3.4 to from three. In other words,
up to 6.8. Right. Yeah.
Sorry, to make the interest rate go back up to 6.8, it had been cut down to 3.4 in 2007, would be a huge burden on families. We're approaching $1 trillion of student debt in this country. Average student graduates with $25,000 worth of student debt, and many have much more. So after President Obama proposed this, Fox News commentators and other people jumped on it and said it was a waste. But I think Mitt Romney realized, and then Boehner, that you don't want to associate yourself with something that would be so harmful to the middle class and to people aspiring to do something and get ahead in this economy. So now the fight is about, well, where are the savings going to come from? And we're back to a familiar story. The Democrats say it should come from making the wealthier people pay a little bit more, pay their fair share. Boehner is suggesting that we cut from health care for, you know, for average Americans. So that's the fight we're going to have now.
So the exclusive that you've broken here, David Halpern, at republicreport.org, on the Washington Post, Kaplan, and other for-profits being a part of ALEC, the controversial special interest lobby group that I've been covering for some time, but it became quite, it got sort of smoked out during the Trayvon Martin case that still is ongoing, having pushed that so-called model law of stand your ground around the country. But they've done so much more than that, and they've been going on for some time. And I guess it's not a surprise that they're pushing this piece of flagrant corporate welfare, which is the for-profit college industry. Just an example of some of the, you know, the Washington Post company, which owns Kaplan, it's under investigation by at least four states' attorney generals, where 68% of college students drop out before graduating. And the previous CEO received a $76 million compensation package when he left. That's your money, taxpayers, we're talking about here. Bridgeport Education, under investigation by at least six states' attorney generals in 2009, spent more than $2,000 per student on recruiting and only $700 per student on instruction. And it has an 84% dropout rate. Corinthian College, under investigation by at least six states' attorney generals, with a 66.5% dropout rate. And so it goes. I mean, and what protects these people on Capitol Hill is their lobbying group called the APSCU, hiring expensive lobbyists like Senator Trent Lott. Let's talk about the APSCU.
Well, they lobby on behalf of most of the big for-profit colleges, but the for-profit colleges then also feel that's not enough, and they hire other lobbyists. I know many lobbyists since I worked in the Clinton administration, people who went into that business, and since I've been in Washington a long time. These are nice people, but they've all taken money to represent a terrible position, taking your tax dollars and using them to systematically ruin the lives of people who are struggling, get taken in by this deceptive recruiting, and sign up for these programs that do them no good. And when they got caught, that's the real scandal here, right? And we've talked about this before. They did a terrible thing. They're doing a terrible thing to people out in the field. When they got caught, they could have said, okay, we'll change our business model. We'll reform. We'd still like to make money. We'd still like to be in the education business, and we'll try and do it in a way that isn't so destructive. Instead, they hired all these lobbyists with our money, because their money comes from taxpayers. And although there was a law that said you cannot use taxpayer money to pay for your lobbyists, money is fungible, so there was really no problem. So they've hired all these lobbyists, and they get 90% of their money, many of them, from the federal government. The lobbyists come in and say, oh, what they're doing is just fine. And they co-opt people, they co-opt nonprofit organizations, and they basically fought to a draw, or maybe won a little bit, and beat back this regulation that President Obama proposed to try to say, if two-thirds of your students can't pay back their loans, maybe you shouldn't be in this business anymore. And they pushed back on that, and now the rule's a little bit weaker. But I think what happened in the course of all this debate, and your show, and so many other people in the media focusing on this, is that more potential students and more citizens became aware of the extent to which this is a scam. So I think ultimately they will have to clean up their business model or they'll have to go away. But they are trying things like joining the American Legislative Exchange Council, which, as you mentioned, is doing all kinds of other terrible things in other areas like the voter ID law, the Stand Your Ground law, and lots of other special interest lobbying. And they think, well, this is another way we can get at the table and try to have an impact on states, because states are starting to say, too, in addition to the federal, in addition to people like Senator Harkin and Senator Hagan in Washington, the states are starting to say, our students are getting ripped off, we need to do something about this.
And this group, APSCU, that we're talking about, its members include DeVry, ITT, ATI, Education Management Corporation, Career Education Corp, and Mitt Romney's favorite, Full Sail University. Tell me about that.
Okay, well, this was a New York Times story, and I actually was in it, and I talked to the reporter and got quoted. Because what Mitt Romney was saying in New Hampshire and Iowa back in December was, you know, they'd ask about higher education. He'd say, well, there's a wonderful school in Florida called Full Sail University. It's a wonderful place. Well, some of their programs have a 14% graduation rate. They have, at best, a mixed record of success. They're a very expensive school. Some people there do get good opportunity, good training, get jobs, but it's so expensive it cannot be the model for a future of education in the United States. So was Romney just sort of gullible? Or, I mean, he kept saying he likes the free market. Well, this, again, not a free market program. 90% of the money for these schools comes from federal financial aid, so it's really more a government program. But then it got worse when we found out that the CEO of Full Sail University and the CEO of the company that owns Full Sail University gave money to Mitt Romney's campaign, and then they actually gave tens of thousands, maybe over $100,000, I'm sure by now more than that, to the super PAC that supports Mitt Romney. So it shows the kind of capitalism that Mitt Romney is talking about. It's a kind of crony capitalism. You give me money for my campaign, then I announce that you're the future of education. So I've started calling Mitt Romney. It hasn't caught on yet. If George Bush said he wanted to be George Bush Sr., the education president, I think Mitt Romney is trying to wear the crown of the for-profit education president. And unfortunately, for-profit education also often has much more to do with profit than it has to do with education.
And Mitt Romney was speaking very early in the campaign in New Hampshire to students who asked him questions about the burdens that they were enduring and facing in terms of student loans. And then he basically said, you know, isn't it wonderful at the marketplace? You can shop around and get all these great deals.
Right.
Well, it's just absolutely, because he lies with such alacrity. He's almost sociopathic. That guy scares me, frankly. I mean, it's unbelievable. Everything that he says is almost a lie. And his first commercials that he came out with in his first campaign in Iowa were totally dishonest, where he put John McCain's words in President Obama's mouth. And yet here he is, the exemplar of a decent family Christian values. So go figure. But anyway, I'm getting off the track here a little
bit. Well, and I'll tell you something else beyond this crony capitalism theme. His son is in a business, Solomir Partners. We've written about this on Republic Report. You can check these stories out. His son, Tag, that invests in gives people an opportunity to invest in companies, including ones that own other sort of destructive for-profit colleges. And the money for Solomir Capital, the seed money to start it, came from Mitt Romney. So he himself is financially linked to these for-profit schools. And so if you elect him, you're basically electing a corporation to be president of the United States. And so if you like that kind of thing, I mean, Republic Report is a nonpartisan organization, and we've actually attacked President Obama and said he was sellout of the week one week because he seemed to be giving up on campaign finance reform and embracing his super PAC and everything else. But we do not like it when people of either party are basically buying into a corrupt system where lobbyists own candidates and candidates do favors for lobbyists. That's not the country that we want to live in.
Again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, senior fellow at Republic Report, where he has a exclusive Washington Post, Kaplan, and other for-profit colleges joined ALEC. The APSCU, the trade group that is the umbrella for lobbying and having these conferences for this group of the for-profit college industry, which gets $32 billion in student aid of your tax dollars every year, they're holding their next convention in June the 22nd at the Mandalay Bay Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. And who should be the keynote speaker? None other than George W. Bush will be speaking. Of course, he basically opened the vault to these people and threw away the keys, didn't he, in his 10 years?
Yes, they decided during the Bush administration that they were not going to heavily enforce rules that prohibited paying for-profit college recruiters sort of by the pound for how many people that they were able to recruit. They said the penalties would be a slap on the wrist. The person who wrote that memo for, you know, was the Deputy Secretary of Defense of Education for President Bush, who approved the memo, is now Mitt Romney's top education advisor. So President Bush is going to go to this conference, and he should be, you know, sort of recognized as the father, as you say, of the very permissive, you know, flood of waste, fraud, and abuse that's happened with your tax dollars with respect to for-profit colleges. We're also, I was somewhat disappointed to read that Michelle Rhee, who is was the former chancellor of the public schools in Washington, D.C., and a very well-known sort of education reform figure in this country, is also speaking at that. She's supposed to be for fighting against failing schools, and she's speaking to a room of failing schools when she goes to that convention. And I think, you know, the fact that she's speaking doesn't, you know, constitute an endorsement of the entire industry. But I don't think that people who really believe in educating our children should be at that thing, because it is people, it is corporate executives masquerading, in a sense, as education officials. They're not concerned with the welfare of their students. They're mostly concerned with the welfare of their fellow executives, I think. If they really cared about their students, they'd spend more money in education, less money on recruiting, and they wouldn't spend and less money on lobbying to fight efforts for accountability. It's remarkable that APSCU, the trade association that you mentioned of for-profit colleges, is against rules that hold schools accountable, because what they're saying is we're going to be fighting for the worst actors in our sector, not for the best, because if there were serious rules, those would favor the schools that were ethical and that were actually helping students.
Well, I must say that I watched Arne Duncan, the education secretary, last night on Rachel Maddow, and he was less than inspiring. She finally asked about this for-profit racket, and he said, oh, there's some good actors, and, you know, they're not all bad. He doesn't seem to be on the case here. This is money that he is actually, he's writing the checks, isn't he?
He is writing the checks, and he hasn't been, I mean, he did push, you know, a fairly strong rule. And he was part of the process where the rule was weakened. I don't know exactly who made the final decision about that. He's done some good things for sure, but he doesn't. Given that we should feel moral outrage about this very arrogant industry that we are paying for, that act like barons. You know, at least Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates. You know, there may have been some antitrust and privacy violations along the way, but they made their money in the marketplace. For-profit colleges make their money through taxpayers and lobbying and deception. And so these people, the Secretary of Education, the President, they should feel outraged that this is happening with our dollar. And the Congress, by the way, in the House of Representatives, there was recently in February a vote again on whether you're going to hold these schools more accountable. In fact, it was a vote to say to hold them less accountable. Every single Republican member of the House of Representatives and a good chunk of the Democrats voted with the for-profit colleges. The Republican Party is supposed to stand for limited government and honest government and not having waste, fraud, and abuse at taxpayer expense. You've seen John Stossel or Jerry Willis on Fox News. They talk about these things. And yet, every single Republican voted to say that we'd rather stand with bad actors in the for-profit college industry than try to channel the money towards ethical or responsible actors, and they're the ones who are actually helping students. It's just remarkable what a racket this is, and the way so many politicians have just decided that in exchange for not even that much money, but a, you know, modest amount of campaign cash from these schools, which again is coming from us, the taxpayer, because that's where, what they're creatures of, that they'll vote for these schools regardless of the facts. It's shocking. I mean, I must say, I left my job running Campus Progress, working with young people, but the one piece of it that I've retained, I'm doing a lot of other things, is working on this issue, because I just felt as a parent, as a taxpayer, and as a citizen of this country, that it was just deeply, deeply offensive to me that this stuff was going on in our name and with our money. And you know, most of all, I mean, as I feel for the taxpayers for this big thing, but most of all, it's the students. And I was on the phone with the CEO of Kaplan, interviewing him for a piece I wrote a while ago, and he said, well, you know, you say that we lobby. Well, you've been lobbied, too. I said, yes, the people who came to lobby me were students whose lives were ruined. And then I took them up, we went up to Capitol Hill and lobbied with them, and they told their stories. The students were absolutely, you know, cynically brought into these schools, misled, and ripped off, and then abandoned, and they owe money, and they got nothing out of it. And the other people we brought were former employees of these companies who, when they spoke up and said, there's dishonesty here, we're lying to students, we're lying to the government, were fired. this is, you know, this should not be happening in a world where we have media and we have communication. The facts ought to predominate and prevail, rather than that lies continue to carry the day. And on for-profit colleges, we're not there yet.
Well, just in closing, David Halperin, Apollo Group, which owns the University of Phoenix, they're being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. They're a Wall Street operation. We already established, and the president mentioned this yesterday, talking to a bunch of students in Iowa, that the college debt or the student loan debt now is $1 trillion, exceeding credit card debt in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We know that this business is being financialized, if that's the right word, on Wall Street. And many people have suggested that the student loan racket will become the next subprime racket. Can you explain how that could come to be?
It's just a lot of debt and a lot of people who can't afford to pay it back, and too many people who borrowed, just like people who borrowed on a house they couldn't afford and then couldn't pay back and were left underwater. Same thing. People owe all this money for their education, can't afford to pay it back. And in this case, again, the taxpayer would be left holding the bag. I'll tell you that Gene Sperling, who is the head of the National Economic Council in the White House, former colleague of mine, and a really great person who really cares about our economy, is really the one who's most forcefully made the case that there is a strong parallel between the subprime housing crisis and the education bubble, which is, you know, led by the for-profit colleges. I'll give you one more statistic as we, you know, to close this out. For-profit colleges have 12% of U.S. college students. They get 25% of the federal financial aid, grants, and loans, and they are responsible for 46% of the loan defaults. So 12% of students and nearly half of all the loan defaults. So it is for-profit colleges that's really driving this student debt crisis, and that's why they deserve the label of subprime colleges.
But they're popping up all the time. I see new ones on television advertising. I've never heard of them. They've come out of nowhere. So this is a business that's on the run. I mean, in other words, the bubble is being inflated.
Well, I don't know. I mean, as a result of the debate in the last year, you've seen some of the stocks go down. Some of them have gone up. And, you know, certainly like everything else in the market, it's not that rational, and there are other factors besides rationality and facts that determine the share prices. But, yes, people are still starting. Well, maybe you and I should start one. We can make some quick money. You know, Masters University sounds like a good name.
Hey.
And bring in the students, get the money, and you know, worry about the consequences later, because you get paid up front.
Well, just in closing, I understand there's a lot of talk about the senator from Maine quitting because of she was sick of the lack of bipartisanship. Her husband runs up some big for-profit college operations being investigated. Isn't that the case?
That's correct. He is the chairman, former Governor McKernan of, I'm afraid I'm going to say the wrong one, but I believe it's Education Management Corporation, EDMC. And I don't know why she quit, but I do, I don't always think that people should be charged with the crimes of the person that they're married to, or have, be forced to recuse themselves from everything because of who they're married to. But I do think that company has a lot to answer for in terms of the way it's misled people. And there's the federal government has joined the lawsuit against them. I hope I have there's so many companies. I hope I have the facts right. If I don't, I apologize. But I believe that's all correct. And I think that, you know, Senator Snow, maybe if she, you know, wants to do something productive, maybe she should become an advocate now for America's students and especially the ones who've been facing mistreatment by for-profit colleges.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, David Halperin.
Well, thank you for having me, and I appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He has a new article at Republic Report, an exclusive Washington Post Kaplan and other for-profit colleges joined ALEC. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the organizer of the Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Steve Scroven, a board member at Public Citizen and host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen in its second year. He graduated from Yale University in 1979 with a degree in English and began his career as a stand-up comedian. He wrote for television shows including Seinfeld, Everybody Loves Raymond, and Till Death, and co-wrote, produced, and directed An Unreasonable Man, the documentary about the life and career of Ralph Nader. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Scroven.
Thank you, Ian. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, well, thank you. So you've made the documentary on Ralph Nader, and of course, I think the genesis of Public Citizen is so interesting in as much as it came into fruition because of corporate excess and thuggery, I guess. You know, Ralph Nader was investigating the safety of automobiles in this country, and instead of listening to him, the big car companies sicked private detectives onto him, tried to destroy his reputation and slime him. Now we know that's kind
impossible.
Exactly, but it's also a kind of business as usual, unfortunately.
Yep.
And then as a result, they had to pay this enormous settlement, and that became the seed money for Public Citizen. I've got that right, haven't I?
That's correct, yeah. General Motors really financed all of Ralph's crusades, and Public Citizen was sort of the institutionalization of the Nader's Raiders concept that Ralph had had become a star in 1966 simply because they tried to squash him, and he won this invasion of privacy lawsuit.
Well, of course, corporations have gotten smarter since then, and arguably they run our country. They certainly own our politics, if not outright. Almost those they don't own, they rent. Would you agree?
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's really. Public Citizen does two things. We watchdog the government to make sure that agencies like the FDA and the Auto Safety Division are doing their thing. But really, it is about resisting corporate power, sort of being that antidote to K Street.
So how did this come about? This was your brainchild, wasn't it, having this political comedy benefit for Public Citizen?
Yeah, it came about because after I did the movie, I got to know, I had interviewed Joan Claybrook, who is the president for 27 years, starting in 1980, and Sid Wolfe, who is also one of the founders. Joan and Sid and Ralph were all founders, along with Alan Morrison, who founded the litigation group.
Of Public Citizen.
Of Public Citizen. And I was all of a sudden hip to the fact that there were so many of these people that Ralph had Johnny Appleseeded that were doing all of this very important work, and nobody knew about them. It was under the radar. And to me, they were heroes. And, you know, part of what An Unreasonable Man does is kind of bring that story to light. And they, as a consequence, I say consequence because it, you know, ended up costing me more money, but asked me to be on the board. And I'd never been on a board before. And now I find myself going to Washington a couple times a year, and I'm sitting with all these very smart lawyers and doctors and journalists, and I'm a stand-up comedian and a comedy writer. So I was kind of, you know, the comic relief and taking the minutes every once in a while, and I was trying to figure out how can I really help. And I could help because I'm out here in Los Angeles. I can do a stand-up comedy show. That's what I know. So last year I decided to get a bunch of friends and people that I knew together, and we organized this benefit. We called Stand Up for Main Street, and we did it in June, and it was a big hit. We filled a 500-seat theater, and it was a great show with Paula Poundstone and Jeff Garland and Dom Herrera and Bill Burr and Hal Sparks and Andy Kindler, and it went so well they asked me to do it again. And so I kind of found my niche on this board, somebody who'd never been part of an organization before, always been sort of a independent contractor, and that's how I found a role to play.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Scroven, a board member at Public Citizen and host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen in its second year.
I should tell you who's on the show, Ian.
I was about to go through that, but why don't you go through the list?
Well, my friend Ray Romano, Mark Maron from WTF, that great podcast, Dana Gould will be on the show, Wendy Liebman, Eric Rivera, Rick Overton, and Morgan Murphy. It's just a really great lineup, something there for everybody. Right. And I told them that they don't necessarily have to be political, that there'll be plenty of messaging done before, after, in between. So they're going to be funny. I mean, some of them are, you know, political, Mark and Dana in particular, Rick.
Yeah, I've had Mark on. But again, Ray Romano, Mark Maron, Dana Gould, of course, with The Simpsons, Wendy Lieberman with The Late Show with David Letterman, yeah. Rick Overton with The Office, Eric Rivera with The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and Morgan Murphy with Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. Of course, thanks to Jon Stewart, comedy and journalism have been merged, surely.
Well, it's a way that it makes all of this very complex stuff make sense. And I mean, comedians in general seem to be filling a niche to sort of interpret all the hypocrisy. And you have a show like The Daily Show, which takes a video clip of somebody saying something 3 years ago and puts it up against what they're saying now. And why aren't the regular news outlets doing this kind of thing? It takes a comedian to sort of say, hey, all of this stuff's been recorded. Let's put it together and see how they're lying, how they're contradicting themselves, where the hypocrisy is. And it's really kind of very, I don't know. I saw John a couple of years ago at the Emmys. And I said, you're saving America, John. He was very humble about that, though.
Well, unfortunately, I think, Steve Scriven, that what's happened here is that our watchdogs have become lapdogs.
Yep.
And the system that operates when you cover politics, it's all about access. So if you burn your bridges with politicians, you don't have access. And if you don't have access, then the media company doesn't want you. You know. So with no surprise that during Bush Sr.'s regime, ABC's White House correspondent Britt Hume, who later went on to head up Fox News, his finest moment was getting to play tennis on the White House tennis court. So, you know, traditionally journalism was a kind of a class struggle. Working class journalists were always against and naturally suspicious of the establishment. You had Hector MacArthur. I guess the last of that breed would be Jimmy Breslin. Now, if you go to a newsroom or a television studio, a network news television studio, it's kind of like an insurance office. You know, nobody smokes. They all look very corporate. Something's really happened, I think, to journalism.
Well, and I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's about access. And I think why people seem to be turning to comedians is because they can tell the truth. They don't have to couch anything. They don't have to be a politician. They don't have to have this sense of false equivalency or false balance. They can just call a spade, and I think that's refreshing.
Well, I have to tell you, Steve Scriven, as a consumer, as a journalist, I'm a consumer of Public Citizen. And by that, I mean that every day I get maybe 200 or 300 solicitations from right-wing groups who are very well organized. They give you lists of people you can talk to, the talking points of the day, whatever the stories of the day, they're right on top of it. They've got people. Most of what the people are offering and what the people are saying are totally absurd. But the point is they do it,
yeah.
And there's so little on the left in terms of a resource. So every time I need to know what's going on at the Hill and what is the latest piece of mendacity making its way through the Congress, I turn to Public Citizen. And they've been filling me in on the Stock Act recently,
yeah.
And also on that disgusting bill called the Jobs Act.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right, and I do the same thing. It's like you... there's this cacophony of all of these contradictory things out there, and so when I want to know what's really happening, I go to Public Citizen. I go to the website. Since I'm on the board, sometimes I can even make a phone call and say, "Hey, what's the real story?" Like you as a journalist. But yeah, that's the antidote.
So why then is there such a deficit on the left? Do you think, Steve Scriven, in terms of resources, in terms of coordination?
Well, I think it's the classic, you know, known on the left, and major opinion polls will usually back this up. Most people back a progressive agenda, but it's all about organization. Whereas, and actually the Tea Party and the Occupy movement are pretty good crystallizations of this, where the Tea Party is this wealthy, funded by industrialists tapping into that sort of populism. they have the money to get involved in elections and to do demonstrations, whereas the Occupy movement is going to have to depend on organization, and because they don't have the money to play that game. Organization is just a lot harder to do than top-down wealth. So I think that's probably, you know, why.
Well, but I think you mentioned the Occupy movement, Steve Scriven. I mean, that has brought something really remarkable to the table and very enduring, and that is this dichotomy between the 1% and the 99%. And that's, I think, really gotten into the national consciousness. And the comedy benefit that you've organized, Steve Scriven, again, a board member at Public Citizen and host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen at the Writers Guild Theatre this coming Sunday, April 29th at 6:30. KPFK is a proud media sponsor. The very title, Stand Up for Main Street, that smacks of the 99%, because the dichotomy is pretty clear, isn't it?
Yeah.
Between Main Street and Wall Street.
Exactly. Wall Street and K Street. And it's funny because I came up with his name about a year ago before the Occupy movement. So I think Public Citizen really has a role to play, this is in my opinion, as the Occupy movement starts turning their demands into policy. It's an organization like Public Citizen that has the professional expertise to do that and to be the tool that takes whatever is happening, whether it's at a local level or at a national level, and kind of turning it into a campaign, a specific campaign or a specific policy, because we have the professionals who know how to do that. We have our own lobbyists. We're just the lobbyists for the people.
Well, and pretty much on a dime, too. I mean, that's what it seems to me that Public Citizen, of all the public interest lobbyists, has been around for decades, but it's operated very effectively on very little resources. As we mentioned in the beginning, Steve Scriven, it all came from the settlement from General Motors, who were trying to destroy Ralph Nader's career and kill the messenger. And they've done enormous value for money. I take it you're stepping in here because they need help, right?
Well, yes, it's a constant battle to keep the funding up. And when Ralph was running it, he hasn't had anything to do with it for the last 30 years. He was a celebrity. And people, you say Ralph Nader is appearing somewhere, people would come. And then what Ralph does, it's kind of a MO of his, is he starts a group and then gets away from it. So it's not influenced by the vagaries of his popularity. And Public Citizen was a case in point. So in 1980, he kind of turned it over to Sid and Joan. And Joan was the president for 27 years. Robert Weissman is now our president for the last 2 years or so. But none of them are celebrities like Ralph was. So we need to work that much harder to get the message out about the work that we've done, all the lives that have been saved, whether you're talking about airbags, whether you're talking about 23 dangerous drugs taken off the market, access to justice, campaign against Citizens United. It's all of these things. It's a pretty wide portfolio. And, we're kind of lean and mean and can get things done, but we need the support.
Well, you've had a pretty fascinating career, Steve Scriven, the organizer of this.
You can call it eclectic or checkered, depending on your opinion.
Yeah, well, checkered has a sort of a different connotation than eclectic. Having started your career as a stand-up comedian, then you became a television writer for shows such as Seinfeld, Everybody Loves Raymond, Until Death. And I'm curious to know, just in political terms, because that's how, unfortunately, I see the world, that so many of the comedians, one of the things that the right wing gets all sort of lathered up about is Hollywood, as you know.
Sure.
In many ways, you don't turn to Hollywood for your expertise on national security matters, and politicians turn to Hollywood for money. But at least these individuals here in Hollywood with a little bit of money, compared to corporations, it's a joke, seem to have a conscience and seem to want to participate in politics and level the playing field. I mean, we can see what's going on with the corporate PAC money now.
Right.
It's not the 1% that's dictating who our political leaders are in this election. It's the 0.00063%.
A handful of people, yeah.
So far. So
I'm always actually quite proud of people in this town who step up, and of course they get slimed by Fox News. But
right.
One of the thing that always occurs to me, the reality here is that there's no parity in terms of celebrity and actors and talented people. They tend to be on the left and support causes more to do with supporting their fellow citizens than making the already wealthy wealthy. And it's just such a striking difference. You know, you've got George Clooney on the one side and Chuck Norris on the other.
Right.
And in terms of comedians, it's like everybody except Dennis Miller.
Yeah. There are a few, but whatever you think about the quality of what Hollywood puts out, it's essentially this large artist community. And this is my theory based on my own observation. And artists tend to be open, tend to be ahead of the curve, especially in social issues, and therefore will tend to be more liberal. And I think that's one aspect of it. When you talk about the corporations that sort of control everything. I mean, NBC Universal, that's owned by General Electric. Of course, you've got Rupert Murdoch's empire. You've got Disney. These are not exactly paragons of liberalism, but the artists and the individuals and, you know, many of the executives at lower levels tend to be just more open and liberal. And maybe it's because a lot of them just came up from nowhere.
Well, you know, Fox tried to do a right-wing version of The Daily Show, and it lasted all of a day. So
it's hard when you control, when you're on top. Comedy is always easier coming from down below when you're the oppressed, because within every joke is an element of dissent. And if you have nothing to dissent about, then it's harder to be funny. Then you can be funny making fun of the little people, but that tends not to endure.
No, it's usually quite nasty. Well, Steve Scroven, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Scroven, who's a board member at Public Citizen and host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen in its second year. He graduated from Yale University with a degree in English and began his career as a stand-up comedian. He wrote for television shows including Seinfeld, Everybody Loves Raymond, and Till Death, and co-wrote, produced, and directed An Unreasonable Man, the documentary about the life and career of Ralph Nader. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.